History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a couple key steps. One, to ask a few questions, and two, just be willing to be patient enough to listen as memories from long ago rise to the surface again and take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's hard to think of anything that's gripped me more over the years than the stories from those who have had to live in the absence of freedom. They sure view the concept of freedom in a different light, and they help us develop a little different perspective as well. Did you know that the third Friday of September every year is National Prisoner of War and Missing in Action Day? And did you know that nearly 82,000 Americans are still unaccounted for from our wars overseas, with about half of those presumed lost at sea? And did you know that the efforts to locate and recover those heroes are still ongoing? We're going to have more about some of those efforts in a future episode, but I had the chance to attend a special POW MIA recognition this week, and I wanted to devote this weekend's episode to this issue and give you a feel for it through the memories of two men who survived captivity in World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, you can find dozens of ex-POW stories, mostly from World War II, but a few from the Korean War as well. There are also still 1,579 Americans missing and unaccounted for from the Vietnam War, but significant progress has been made on that front in recent years. If you ever found yourself in the courtroom of a judge named M.W. Del Rey, and you happen to lodge a complaint, he might not have had a whole bunch of sympathy for you, given what he went through with the 379th Bomb Group as a B-17 navigator. He had actually been in the Navy Reserve before Pearl Harbor, but when America entered the war, the Navy rejected him because of albumin in his urine. The Army Air Corps was just fine with him, but the navigator role was actually something he requested after Uncle Sam thought of something else.
Well, I went back to Santa Ana, and you had to take this test again, multiple choice. There were three parts to it. Top grade was 9, and I got a couple of 8s and a 9. I know they called me in. The sergeant says, well, we're going to make a bombardier out of you. And I said, I don't want to be a bombardier. I want to be a navigator. And he said, well, you have to go see the major. So I went and see the major, and major looked at the record. He says, give him what he wants. If he wants to be a navigator, go ahead. I got back with the other guys and found out guys were getting 6s and 7s on that test. But I was, as I say, I knew how to take it. They didn't know how to take the test, and that's the reason I got high, and they didn't.
And why, in your mind, was it preferable to be a navigator as opposed to a bombardier?
I don't know. I want to be a navigator on B-17 and go to Europe. And that's what happened. I didn't want to get shut down. But I did. Anyway, I don't know why. I know a very good friend of mine from Tulare became a bombardier, and he was the only class of 1938 that I know of that was killed in the war, and he got killed over there looking for me. He said, oh, well, that's another story.
He wanted to go find you because he knew you were a prisoner? Is that what you're saying?
He told my folks when he left, he said he'd find me over there, but he didn't. He got shot down. And Jack Russell is his name, yeah. Very good friend of mine.
For you as this young man, and you said you wanted to go over in B-17s and fight this air war in Europe, did you have any idea what that actually meant and what you were actually going to be up against?
No, I didn't know. You didn't know. I knew it was going to be rough because we'd already heard a lot. I thought we knew what we were fighting for, but that was it, yeah.
So what was going through your mind as you headed overseas? You leave behind your family here in the States, not knowing if you're going to come back. What do you remember thinking and looking forward to or even dreading at the time?
I was young, remember? We're young guys. And we're not thinking about not coming back. Although I found out from, there were guys who were getting down about 10% getting shot down every time. And I said, at that rate, we can't make it. And the rest of my crew said, oh, yeah, we can make it. But you didn't think about that stuff. I didn't think about that. Now, some guys couldn't get to the airplane because they were scared to death. I don't know. I never got scared until we got started getting shot at. And then that's when I started getting scared. Yeah.
Well, that's understandable. For people who've never been on a B-17 or weren't alive then and don't know what it was like, tell us about being a navigator on that plane, where you sat, and what your duties were.
Well, in Europe, the navigator really wasn't that important. Lead navigator was, and you had to know where you were at all times, so in case you got shut out of the formation and then had to get home. But primarily, you were probably maybe a commissioned gunner. I had a 50 caliber machine gun on the left and none on the right, so... But we had to know where we were at all times, as I say, and other than that, why, it wasn't that difficult. If you go to the Pacific, then the navigator is really important.
But for you, if you're in formation, the lead navigator leading that flight has to be on target. Otherwise, you guys just trust him. And then, but if you get shot down, as you say, then you've got to adjust and plot a new course, perhaps, huh?
That's right. Of course, it's go west and you can get home.
And anybody that has driven down the 99, and that's millions and millions of people who have passed through Tulare on the 99, and hopefully they notice, if they're heading north, off to their right, a B-17 with a yellow triangle and a big black K in the middle of it. And most people say, hey, I wonder what that stands for. You actually know what that stands for.
Triangle K, yeah, it was the 379th at Kim Bolton, yeah.
That's the 379th Bomb Group, your bomb group. Kim Bolton, England, is where you flew your missions from.
That's right. It's about 20 miles north of Bedford.
When you got to Kim Bolton, and this is 1943, still pretty early in this air war for America and Europe, what was it like there? What did you find?
Kim Bolton's the size of about Tipton, if that's large enough. But a little place and just an airport. What was tough was like they'd want to check out pilots for night landings and they'd have to have a navigator on. And that was, we call them circuits and bounces. But that was an interesting little job.
Make you feel like a guinea pig a little bit?
Yeah, that was tough.
So tell me about your first mission. What do you remember about that? How anxious were you for that to happen?
The first mission, I believe it went over the Ruhr Valley. On the map, all the aircraft deals are in red. The Ruhr Valley is just a big red moon thing there. And when you hit that, it's before you hit it, you get hit by fighters. And then after you hit it, the fighters don't come in and you get you. And I hit that a couple of times, as I recall. And then... one time to run to Kiel, which is north, and we couldn't make it there because it was clouded over. That was when we turned back, and there's an island out in the North Sea called Helgoland, and on that island was German fighters, and they attacked us, and that's when my pilot took violent evasive action, and it was a little too violent and dropped way down, so wonder we didn't get shot down, because they usually hit guys that are out of formation, but we got back in all right.
That sounds a little exciting. Were you scared a little bit?
Yeah. I think we're always scared a little bit, yeah.
And when those fighters come at you, because of where you are, and you described having a 50 caliber to your left, a 50 caliber to your right, are you firing away trying to get a piece of these fighters?
I had one come through the formation right to my right. All I had to do was fire the gun, because he went right past us. But I thought, if I kill him, he might run into the guys behind us. Well, a couple of seconds, he's gone. Didn't even fire a shot. I hate to admit that. Mm-hmm. I did fire one down below us to the left and saw smoke come out and reported it, and they just laughed and said, forget it. You didn't get him. Anyway, I had one. We were flying in formation, being shot. Flak's coming. You can hear the flak on your, like somebody throwing rocks on the tin roof. And this one airplane broke off to the right out for a while. And it just happened. It was an accident, I know, because all of a sudden Flat came out there and he came right back into the formation. I don't know why. I don't know whether it was later I laughed about it, but I think I laughed about it right then. I was scared to death and still laughed at that guy. That was one of the few times something funny.
Yeah, I think that is an odd juxtaposition to be flying and Flak hitting your airplane and you could die at any moment and you're breaking out in laughter. That had to strike your crew funny.
You know, I'm not sure I did it then or it was later, but I know it struck me as being funny. To be honest, I really don't know if I laughed then or not, but I know it struck me funny at the time.
So you've had three missions and encountered pretty stiff opposition on all three of those first three missions?
Well, yeah. Well, the first two and the one to Kiel, got attacked by fighters. That wasn't that bad coming home. I couldn't say that was a bad mission. But the two or the Ruhr Valley, they were tough. I thought that was rough. And then, of course, my last mission was the one.
So this is your fourth mission. And you've got a different pilot than you had on your first mission.
Yeah, we got rid of Fred White and got Bidwell. Anyway, we took off on that mission. Well, that's the one where we got checked. We were being critiqued and navigation critiqued. And I checked the deal and said, well, we're going to get to the French coast 10 minutes early from what it says on this. And the navigation lieutenant there said, oh, don't worry about it.
So your calculations were a little different than theirs.
Yeah, well, I always thought, I never had been able to check, but it always seemed that we got there, we weaved a little bit back and forth and just take some time up so we could meet our...
Fighter escort?
Fighter escort.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you say that. The 8th Air Force has a database online that you can search and pulls up all kinds of records. I pulled up the official report on that mission that day to Le Bourget, France. It said, fighter escort accompanied us almost the entire route. 19 of our aircraft bombed the primary target, which was the airfield and depot at the Le Bourget, Paris, France, at 0932 today. The result of the bombing was considered by several of our crews to be good, and our lead bombardier saw his bombs land on the designated aiming point, from which subsequently there appeared voluminous red flames. 22 of our aircraft were airborne, but one of these was designated as a planned abortive, and he turned back to our base upon reaching the English coast. It was the opinion of some of our crew members, especially those in the high squadron, that the enemy fighter opposition was the most aggressive that they have met so far. On the other hand, they were surprised by the meagerness of the enemy flak over the target. For the most part, the friendly fighter support was effective and on time, but there was a lag of about 10 minutes between the leaving of one fighter group and the appearance of the succeeding fighter group at the IP. It was during this lag that the enemy made his most ferocious attack. Approximately 50 enemy aircraft were encountered. Enemy aircraft slipped in through P-47 formation and came in out of the sun. ME-109s pressed attacks to 75 to 100 yards. Attacks were made in groups of four. Attacks by enemy aircraft were made on the high squadron, did not follow through on other squadrons. And it continues. But when you talk about your calculations being 10 minutes different, and this official Air Force report saying a lag of about 10 minutes is what caused the casualties, it sounds to me that's exactly what happened to you.
Yeah, maybe, I guess so. We weren't the only plane shot down. I think there were two shot down that day out of our group.
So what do you remember happening? Did you start to feel something was wrong when you guys were delaying?
No, I know that we got attacked by fighters, but when we got to the bomb run, I got hit on the bomb run by flak on my arm and in my leg. I still think I have a little piece of flak left in my leg. We got through the bomb run, and then I noticed the whole group was apparently taking up and gaining altitude. And it suddenly dawned on me, the group wasn't gaining altitude. We were going down. It just looked that way. I looked back up through the Astrodome and could see the pilot and co-pilot fighting the plane up there. Well, I know then I got back down, and the bombardier's still up in the nose, and he's not working. Then I looked back down, and right next to my desk and back is the escape hatch. I look back there, and here's the pilot by the escape hatch on the other side of it, and on the catwalk right next to it is the engineer. And I get up there, and the pilot had tried to open the escape hatch against the slipstream, and it wouldn't open. I could look down, and there was, maybe 6 inches, I guess. I could look through it and see the ground coming up. It kept going. We made a couple of swings. We were in a spin going down. And at the bottom of every spin, I could see the ground. And finally, we hit the ground, I thought. And then I thought I could be thinking if I'm dead, you know. And I opened my eyes, oh, I'm falling. And so I pulled the ripcord, the chute opened, and sure enough, my arms and legs, the right leg just flopped. I saw something going. I saw the fuselage going in the ground and something else, I don't know what. Then I saw two ME-109s going about a couple hundred yards, maybe 300 yards, and going to miss me. Then they turned towards me for a little while, and then they turned back. Well, I found out later that the report was that the pilot was killed in his parachute. So I don't know whether they didn't see me or what, but they went on to him. Anyway, I finally landed and hit the ground. The bombardier ran up to me, so we must have pulled our chutes at the same time to be close, you know. Then a German fighter came in and started strafing us, and I told Rader, I said, Wayne Rader was my bombardier, I said, get out of here, he's trying to kill me. Not us, me. And, so, and anyway, Rader looked at him company, and he left. And many years later, I visited him in Oregon. Mm-hmm. I asked him about it. He said, I don't remember that. I was feeling so bad saying he was trying to kill me and not us, you know.
Thankfully, they both survived. But M.W. Del Rey would often wonder in the years that followed if he would have made it out alive without a blessing that may have seemed more like a curse at the time. The seemingly unfortunate way a German doctor handled his broken leg might have been the most fortunate twist of his life. We'll hear that part of the story when this special POW MIA Day edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.